You are listening to Right On Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at KFAI.org. During tonight on Radio, Liz talks with Susanna Drizzy, author of Until We Are Fish. Until We're Fish blends the romance, violence, mood, and ethos of the Cuban Revolution with a young man's hopeless and heroic first love. Susanna Rodriguez Drizzy is an award-winning Cuban-born poet, writer, translator, playwright, director, producer, and scholar. She has a PhD in comparative literature from UCLA, where she teaches in the writing programs.
And I'm Liz Olds. In the last part of the hour, Dave Bettig chats with Brian Satram, author of Starting Again, a collection of poems, some of which have appeared in Cedar River Press Review, Poetry Northwest, and Rattle, among other publications. His work has been nominated for a Pushcart Prize. Brian lives and writes in Minneapolis. All of this and more, so stay tuned to Right On Radio. Susanna, are you there?
I'm here, Liz. How are you?
Pretty good. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing well. Excited to be on.
Well, welcome to Right On Radio. Do you have your reading
Thank
first?
You. I do.
You can go on with that.
All right. Thank you. So this is from chapter 13, and it takes place in 1969, some years after the triumph of the Cuban Revolution of 1959, so about a decade later. A month and a day after their wedding, the sun was high and the sea was a glittering blue as Elio and Maria walked to the shore at Baracoa Beach. A surge of large, smooth waves came toward them, frothing up around their feet. They held hands and kissed, letting the ground sink beneath them as the waves pulled back into the sea. "Come on," Maria said. "We didn't come here for nothing." She was standing on one foot, with her arms outstretched, playing burnt flamingo under the sun. Her skin had turned a bright red, and Elio feared she'd had enough sun for one day. He stared out toward the quiet menace that was all that water, a machine with machine-like creatures lurking beneath the surface. He didn't have the heart to swim. He simply couldn't do it. His legs wouldn't move. His body wouldn't budge. He was terrified. "You go," he told her, even as his heart beat fast for her and for what he knew could happen in the water. "Come on, don't be a ninny," she said, hopping, laughing, and pulling him by the hand. Elio could do nothing more than hold his ground. "No," he said, lifting her hands to his mouth to kiss them. "I'm not getting in the water." "Fine," she said, pulling her hands away. "I'll go in alone this time, but you'll have to get over your fear sooner or later." Elio watched as her body broke the waves and disappeared into the sunlight. He walked back to their towel and sat down. While he waited impatiently for her to come back, he tried to read, but his head was nowhere near Lincoln Island in the Nautilus. It was with Maria, and he hoped, prayed, she'd come back from the water in one piece. He felt sick to his stomach. They spent all afternoon at the beach telling each other stories. He, the one about the guy who found a cave full of gold and silver and precious stone. She, the one about the magic lamp, and the one about the sailor. Then she said they should start with the greatest book ever written in any language. "Once you read it, you'll never be the same," she said. And she told him about windmills and giants and about the greatest of friendships between a caballero and Dante and his squire, and about the caballero's unbounded love for his Dulcinea. Elio was mesmerized by the lull of her voice. "This will be a story long enough to last us all the years we'll spend together," Maria told him. Elio loved the idea, and he loved her. She told each story with great care, tenderly, quietly, rounding out every word as though each time was the first and the last time she'd pronounce, "Había una vez." Sitting beside her on the sand, Elio concluded that Maria knew all there was to know about loving him. Perhaps she could guess that as long as there were words and as long as there were stories, that he would want to hear again the next day and the next day after that, she would save him. And there would be no other destination than Maria, because she would be the only place he would ever want to be, his one and only story. And they made so many plans, which they erected before them like sandcastles, as elaborate as the stories they told and just as beautiful. They decided where and how they would live, who their friends would be, and what they would wear and eat and watch on TV, and how they would never let anyone dictate their lives or make choices for them or make them feel unwelcome or afraid, because they were young and this life was new, and like all new things, they were wrapped up in dreams. Though he tried to remember the finer details of each story, colors, sounds, and textures, his mind drew a blank, choosing instead to imagine Maria choking and swallowing water. Absorbed in the one task of getting another breath, her body flailed hopelessly against a force she couldn't see. Unable to wait any longer, Elliot ran to the shore and looked out over the water. Children waded in and out of the surf, while a small blue motorboat crawled slowly toward the pier. Elliot couldn't see anybody on it, and he couldn't see Maria in the water. His heart beat faster. He pushed into the surf far enough for the water to reach his calf, but he froze. He couldn't go any further. Maria, his voice came out broken. Swim back. A beat, then another, and suddenly there she was. In the distance, Maria, a small dot in the sea of sunlight, saw him and waved. Elio waved back, squinting. I think you should get out of the water, he shouted, his heart pumping in his chest. I'm coming, she yelled back.
And that was Susanna Drissy, and a passage from When We're Fish. Susanna, why don't you start by giving us a brief overview of the book, and I'm curious what the title means, if you wouldn't mind telling us that.
Okay. So the title, Until We're Fish, it's about a young man. It begins when he's 13 years old. Right the day before the Cuban Revolution, the triumph of the Cuban Revolution, or the day before Castro marches into Havana. And we see him grow up through the years, from 1959 all the way to 1995. And throughout these years, Elio is obsessed with two things. The first one is Maria, his next-door neighbor. And the second one is an American bike, a Schwinn bike, a beautiful red bike that he saw once on a window at a Sears in Havana, and that he has never been able to have. So we follow him through his relationship with Maria, and through the challenges that the revolution represents for not only these two characters, but their friends and family members. As the revolution first goes through a honeymoon period, then a kind of quiet time, and disillusionment, disenchantment. So that takes us all the way to 1995.
Your novel starts in 1959, and that's the beginning of the Cuban Revolution. You've talked some about it, but I'm wondering, for our listeners who don't know much about it, if you could talk a little bit more about the revolution and what it meant and who was on what side and so on.
Well, the revolution, you know, it's a complicated conversation to have, right, about the revolution, since at the very beginning, you know, I think there were plenty of people who cheered on and expected this change to come about, a much needed change, I think, to the island. It had been under a dictatorship before, which was Batista's regime. And so when Castro comes about, some were against the change, but many people were hopeful that the revolution would bring with it great change for the people, in particular those who were on the fringes, those who were, at the lower levels of the Cuban economic ladder. And what happens in all revolutions, that promises made at the beginning don't really pan out. The goals are not met, and instead what you get is slowly steps toward a dictatorship. And so this is how the characters find themselves at the very end. You know, hopeful at the beginning, as any young couple would be in a honeymoon period with their own marriage and with the revolution. But by the very end, the changes that were promised at the beginning haven't really been delivered. And so there's disillusionment, and there is much unfulfilled desire for all the characters in the novel, unfulfilled dreams. And they all cope with these dreams in different ways.
Bicycle, as you mentioned, the red Schwinn bicycle, plays a significant role in the imagery of the book. And I'm wondering if you could talk about the image and the several bikes that appear in the story.
Yeah. So bicycles, you know, they're very special to me. I think in general, bicycles are very special to children and adolescents. They're the first moment of independence where, you know, you leave home, not in a car, but on a bicycle. So it's pre-driving. For more humble nations, I think a bicycle substitutes the automobile. And so for many people, it's the only method of transportation besides their own feet, right? So in Cuba in particular, bicycles were much loved. And the bicycle, the Shrin bicycle in this case, I like to think that it represents the dreams that are unfulfilled for our main character, Elio, before the revolution, because he desires the bicycle before the triumph of the Cuban Revolution of 1959. And also the same dreams continue to be unfulfilled after the revolution. So even after the revolution, and a revolution that has made so many promises, Elio cannot get his bikes. And he has moments where he's close. You know, there's a Soviet bike that he purchases, you know, an old Soviet bike that he purchases from an athlete who has been to the Soviet Union. I think this takes place in the 70s. And unfortunately, like many of the Soviet products that would get to Cuba, they would fall apart. And so as poor Elio is riding his bike down a hill, the bike starts, you know, the pedal goes one way, the wheel goes another way. And so there goes his first bike. And then there's a Chinese bike, and these Chinese bikes were very popular in the 1990s. Some of them were called Flying Pigeons. And once again, he's at work. He's tried really hard. He's gone to every meeting, to every protest, every kind of volunteer work that you could think of, because he was told that as a bonus, he would get a Chinese bike. Unfortunately, he's passed up for the bike. He doesn't get the bike, and he decides that if he can't get the bike, he's going to build one himself.
Mm.
And so out of spare parts, he starts building this bike that he says is going to be the tallest bicycle on the island, or at least the tallest bicycle in his little town, right?
Mm-hmm.
Once again, the dreamist doesn't pan out, as his wife, Maria, is afraid that, you know, all these crazy ideas that he has and his ingenuity and that will get them in trouble. It would be against the regime's ideological demands. And so she asks him to tear down the bike, and he's heartbroken, but he does it. And then there is his best friend's bike, which he later inherits. And something happens to that one, to that one too. So he never gets the bike that he has dreamt about. And, you know, the bike, like I said at the beginning, is that one thing that he couldn't have before and after the revolution. So to me, it represents the lack of real change between the two regimes.
Mm-hmm.
And also, of course, you know, just in general, childhood dreams, the desire for the northern neighbor, as well as an American bike. It's not just any bike that he desires when he's 13 years old. And so it also represents that, right, the northern neighbor or America calling out to him through this one bike.
Another image that is very interesting is books. Maria loves books, and then she doesn't, and Elio doesn't love books, and then he does, and he starts stealing them from the library and whatnot. what is your concept or your image? What are you trying to convey with that whole idea?
Well, I mean, books, and this was true for me. I grew up in Cuba. And so we didn't arrive in the United States until 1981. And there wasn't, you know, there wasn't much in Cuba. I was lucky that my mom was a local librarian. And so I would get books that way. My dad, you know, would do what he could to find me a book. I was, you know, an avid reader. And books really were an escape, you know, an escape for me. There were no toys, not a lot to do or places to go to. And so books became that other world that I could visit and escape to whenever I needed to. And I needed to quite a bit. And so in the novel, they're definitely that, you know, they're both friend and foe at the same time. And in some cases, they keep the characters from really appreciating the life that they're living through, or not necessarily appreciating, but really, really dealing with their reality. And in other cases, they provide they become a kind of therapeutic device that they use to be able to survive the nothingness of every day. And so, you know, we have two characters here that love books very much. Like you said, Elio didn't like books at the beginning, or at least he didn't let on that he did. And because of Maria, because she loves books, he starts reading in a way to impress her. And he becomes very fond of books. He has a stash under his old thin mattress. And on the other hand, Maria, as reality starts seeping in through her fantasy life, she ends up getting rid of books altogether. And for me, it's, you know, I guess I think that for characters or for people who are in dire circumstances, it's very hard to find the time to read a book. Reading is a kind of privilege. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Maria is too worried about what she's going to eat the next day, too worried about the leaking refrigerator that, you know, she inherited, and in this case, probably inherited from her grandmother, and trying to figure out survival to actually be able to get into any story that takes her away from that. Elio, on the other hand, he continues to hang on. And one book that he absolutely loves and has cost him some trouble is Don Quixote, Cervantes, you know, great work, Don Quixote. And, you know, this is really important. Don Quixote was a character who, in spite of many challenges, in spite of all the beatings that he gets throughout his journey, he continues to take that leap of faith into the future, into the next quest. So to me, the fact that Elio loves Don Quixote means that this is a character who really represents the best of the human spirit. Someone who, in spite of everything that's happening in his life, people leaving, so many people leaving the island, so many things happening to him, the poor relationship he has with his dad and all of that, he continues to dream. Every morning he gets up and he has a new idea, a new dream, and he takes that leap of faith. And so books, in this case, or that leap of faith, I think, not only the reality of fiction, the truth in fiction, but the kind of dream that a book represents and that Elio is willing to dive into every day.
Talk about your relationship to Cuba. You were born there, correct?
Yes.
And you say that it's your point of departure and sometimes your point of arrival. And I'm curious what that means to you, your whole relationship with Cuba.
So Cuba is both a very joyful and very painful subject to take on. Joyful because, you know, it's where I come from. My roots are there. I spent many years of my childhood there. And, you know, I still have family there. All of that, but also painful because it's what you left and what you left behind. And so as far as a point of departure, I guess what I mean is it's, you know, it's the origin and from the kind of lens that it provides for me and the sort of peeping hole I look through when I look at the world. Not always, you know, not always. I'd like to think that I've traveled enough to be able to to understand the world through other lenses, but you can't rub off your origin. So mm-hmm. in this case, you know, I think Cuba informs really much of the work that I do in one way or another, even when the work is not about Cuba at all, but there's a kind of Cuban sensibility or humor or, you know, everything becomes sort of a Caribbean jest or something like that. And what I return to, well, it's kind of like chicken soup, you know, or soul food. It's the place that when everything else goes wrong, that sort of the place in my mind or in my emotional and psychological well-being that I return to and crawl to when things are, you know, when things are not so good. In this case, for this novel, this was certainly a way of returning for me. It's something that I looked forward every day as I was writing it to enter that world again that had been so long since I had visited. And I've been back a couple times since then, since I left. But certainly this was a return in the sense that I was able to bring to life the places that were familiar to me. The house where these characters live was my house as a child.
Mm-hmm.
Elio and Maria were, you know, my great aunt and uncle. Not everything is, you know, strictly autobiographical, but there's certainly a lot of that in this novel because, you know, it's the place that I went to be able to mine for images and information. You know, a lot of the things that, or the situations that the characters have lived through in the novel are situations that I lived through while we were in Cuba. So it's a real experience that you're getting, not necessarily an inherited story, if that makes sense.
Yes. It makes me think about home. There's a lot of there's people who want to go to the United States. There's people who want to stay at home. The characters seem to be looking for home a lot. And I'm mm-hmm. could you speak to that?
Yeah, it's terrible. You know what you say. It's very true. There are people who are not at home. You know, and I think that's a terrible, terrible feeling, right?
Yes.
The place that it's supposed to provide for you, the kind of comfort of home, the hospitality and protection of home, has turned against them in many ways. And so everyone is looking for a home or a house that represents the home. Like, for example, for Maria, through some of the chapters, she's hoping to be able to get this home. And in Cuba, you can't, or you couldn't at this time. I think, you know, recently things have changed. But at the time, you couldn't sell your house. And so what would happen if you wanted to move or gift your home to someone, inherit your home to someone, you did a swap. So you would have to go to their home and they would come to yours. So homelessness, in many ways, has become the sort of trope, you know, for Cubans even on the island.
We're coming to the end, believe it or not, of our time. I have a kind of a double question.
Okay,
you're a very accomplished writer with many publications and awards, and I'm wondering how this has changed you as you've moved forward in your writing and your connection to writing and yourself as a writer. And then I'd also like to know what's next.
I think I have that immigrant drive in many ways, Liz. So, you know, I don't think it has changed me too much, except in the sense that, you know, I feel like I have always felt since I was very young that I was running out of time.
Mm.
I didn't think at some point that I was going to make it to 50. So, you know, my own ideas, there was nothing really, you know, maybe teenage drama or what have you, but I've always felt that I'm running out of time. And now as I get older, I am running out of time, it turns out. And so I just feel like I need to get all those stories and all those ideas down on paper or whatever platform, you know, I end up choosing. And what's next? I have a musical coming up soon. We're hoping it was due to premiere in Miami at the Kubik Center August 6th, but then, you know, COVID hit. And that was postponed. We're looking forward to hopefully at the end of this year bringing it on again to Miami first. It's a wonderful musical about radio, actually.
Cool.
yeah. And then there's that. It's called Nocturno. And then I have a translation that's hopefully coming soon of short stories by a very famous and important Cuban writer and ethnographer who was writing at the time of Zora Neale Hurston. So she was doing a lot of work similar to the work that Hurston was doing in Eatonville, Florida. There's that. I have a second novel called Letters from Camus, which I've been working on for some time too. And, you know, a few other things that I can't remember right now, but that I know are pending, you know. So that's what's next, you know, a lot and hopefully helping my two beautiful daughters navigate online schooling. That's also nice.
Oh, yes. Boy, many projects, many projects. Well, we've reached the end of our time. Thank you so much. This has been a wonderful interview. I've enjoyed talking to you very much. And we will have to say goodbye now.
Okay, goodbye. Thank you so much for having me, Liz.
Oh, thank you for being here. You too. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Right on Radio on KFAI.org. I am Dave, and I'm here this evening with Brian Satram. Brian, am I spelling that correctly, or am I pronouncing it correctly?
You're doing both. You've got it spelled and pronounced correctly.
Fantastic. So welcome to the show. Congratulations on the book.
Thanks so much. It's wonderful to be on the show.
Great, great. It's no small thing to put together a book of poems, so I congratulate you on that. And before we get a listen to one of your poems, because here on Right on Radio, we believe poems were meant to be heard, but let's hear a little bit about you. You've kind of spent your time around the country, if not the world. How'd you end up in Minneapolis?
Oh, gosh. My parents were from the Midwest, but we traveled around a lot when I was growing up, and I went to college at McAllister College. I finished high school at Edison High School in Northeast Minneapolis. I went to college at McAllister, took some creative writing classes,
nice.
Really got hooked into writing and poetry there. Did a few odd jobs after college, and then did an MFA at the University of Maryland. And I probably thought I was going to whip out a book of poems. You know, I was young and cocky, or just whip out a book of poems just like that after the MFA. And it's been a lot longer journey, but it's been a good journey. I'm still on it, so.
Well, good for you. And you're here in Minneapolis, right where you belong. So you answered my second question before we have a reading, which is, what's your relationship to poetry? Is that when you got started writing poetry in college?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Have you kept it up since?
And I've kept it up since. Just some wonderful people I took classes with. I think that's initially sort of what drew me in.
Great.
And then I realized there was something more going on that was attracting me about the writing process. So, yeah.
Fantastic. Well, you clearly have a knack for it. So let's give our listeners a sense for what you're all about and give us a reading, if you would, please.
Yeah, thanks. There are a few poems in the collection that are about not having children. I thought I'd read one of those. And it's also timely in that Halloween enters into the poem and Halloween's right around the corner. So the poem is called With Time. I'm the one to hollow the pumpkin and carve a face. The doorbell rings again. You adore the children tonight in their costumes. A warm night. We have no costumes, just the two of us and the space between, forming a shape we keep repeating. My turn to go and hand out candy. We finally threw away the photo from the booth that merged our faces, a composite to show what a daughter of ours might look like. She looked freaky, not being real. This isn't yours alone to carry, isn't your failure. We won't let us drift apart, but there's nothing to work on or figure out. With time, you'll say your body doesn't crave being a mother anymore. You can't say it now. Your silence, a place into which I don't know how to follow you.
That was Brian Satram reading from his poetry collection, Starting Again. Brian, that's a very powerful and personal poem. I admire you for reading it. I have to ask you, is it hard for you to write about things like this and put these feelings, these experiences out there for the world?
Yeah, it's a challenge. It's working my way up to it through language. It's playing around with language and working myself there. I didn't just start out thinking, oh, I was going to write this poem. And I think that's a writing process for me. For a lot of what I write, it's a discovery process. It's a messing around with words, and that allows me to kind of work my way to things like this. And I should mention it, you know, obviously it's personal to me, but it includes details about my wife too. So I'm grateful to, she doesn't always have a choice, but I'm grateful to her for going along with me on the ride sometimes too.
I was going to ask you that, because poets often write about their lives, and their lives involve other people, and sometimes very raw stories come out in poems, and I think it's very brave to do, and it's a beautiful poem. Thank you for reading.
Thank you.
Another theme in your book, at least as I've read it, you can tell me if I'm fair. Is this a fair reading? And I would say the word belonging, and I'd say that because a poem may be about or in a place in California, then we're in Minnesota, then maybe we're in Wisconsin, and then we're just in some undefined location, but place seems very much a part of many of these poems. Is that a fair reading?
That's a great reading. I really appreciate your noticing that. So I think belonging is important because I've lived a lot of different places. It's belonging, and it's also reflecting back on those places and my experiences there. And I think another theme are very small. I mean, these are all sort of ordinary experiences, but they're all, I think they include small disconnects or just little loose threads or something like that. So that belonging or that sense of longing for belonging might come from a sense of a little disconnect that's explored in the poem as well. So, yeah. LA was an area that I've spent quite a bit of time in, and Madison, Wisconsin as well. So yeah,
I love Madison.
Yes.
So speaking of place, I was thinking about this as I'm sitting here in this increasingly COVID-ized world, and that's an ugly word. But as a poet, what has COVID been like for you? Sheltering in place, social distancing. I'm gonna make a assumption here that for a poet, that's pretty good. I mean, leave me alone and let me write. How have you reacted as a writer to living in a COVID world?
It's been mixed. For one thing, my book came out in the middle of COVID, so all these various plans I had for letting people know about the book. Yeah. But actually, it's been fine because things have happened in ways that I didn't expect. So that's fine. The writing has been on and off in COVID because my whole world's been turned upside down, in as have all of ours. So, you know, I think my writing actually comes out of a lot of silence, and it doesn't just flow out. So, I've had that experience this last year where I've spent a lot of quiet time writing stuff that hasn't come together at all, and then there'll be these little clumps of things that'll come together, whether it's images or ideas. It's been mixed, as has been my sort of emotional experience in this time. So,
well, you started addressing one of my favorite questions for writers, especially poets, which is how you work. That is to say, whether poems, you know, are born fully formed in your mind and you just write them down, or, you know, you struggle, you drip blood on the page, you know, all these sorts of, you know, metaphors.
The latter.
It's good to hear. I hate it when it's easy.
It's not just dripping blood. It's a discovery. It's an exploring, it's a feeling my way around in the dark a little bit, but with words. So yeah. There a lot of words get put on the page, but they're not all the ones that end up in the poem. And there's an awful lot of stuff that can get written on the page. It just does not end up in any kind of a poem at all.
Sure.
Yeah.
Let's hear another one.
Yeah.
If you don't mind, Brian, maybe give us one. You know, pick a place poem, if you will, a belonging poem. How does that sound?
I'd love to.
Something else lined up and then throwing you off.
I'd love to. You were talking about Madison, how much you love Madison. So here's a Madison poem for you.
I like it.
And it is also that reflecting back, and it's also that a little incongruity, and just observing that. It's called From Within. Lake Monona, Madison, Wisconsin. Acolytes of the sluggish, muggy dark, their dozen or so rods, the tip of one dipping into the still water, crowded around a spot where street runoff empties into the lake, black and Hmong anglers casting from shore, some sitting on large plastic buckets, and white anglers from aluminum boats they've brought in close. A ball game on a radio, bobbers with lights like fireflies above the surface, though fireflies don't hover above surfaces or bob, but trace part of an arc like a match as it's tossed away. Otis Redding's plane went down here on the way to his next show. I doubt he knew the name of the lake, his thoughts other places when he traveled. If you walk this path certain times of day, you'll notice a loon close enough to see the red in its eye. Strange, in the reflection of a power plant, of four tall smokestacks and a city skyline. Have you caught a fish of any kind? From within that stillness, you feel a tug. At first, you're not sure what it is, your heart thumping in your chest.
Great. That was Brian Satram reading from Starting Again, his collection of poems. I'll remind our listeners that they are listening to Write on Radio on KFAI FM 90.3, a community supported radio station, ladies and gentlemen. As you well know, we just ended our pledge drive of fall or / winter, whatever it is right now. Thanks to all you who donated, and hey, you can do that anytime at kfai.org. So thanks for that. And I'm glad you read this poem, Brian, because I love it. And I was going to bring it up in this regard. I love this metaphor of the bobbers. I'm going to read this again, if you'll allow me.
Yeah.
Bobbers with lights like fireflies above the surface, though fireflies don't hover above surfaces or bob, but trace part of an arc like a match as it's tossed away. So that actually made me smile, almost laugh out loud, because This suggests some confidence in your writing in the sense that you would suggest a metaphor, but right away say, you know, that's really wrong. And anyone who's paying attention is going to realize that I just really goofed on this poetry thing here. And then you give us this beautiful description of the match as it's tossed away as the arc of a firefly. And so I thought that was really clever, and that shows a certain confidence in your writing. So I admire that. And I'll call out one more. Similarly, but out of nowhere, which is it's a sort of a meta moment here where you address the reader directly. Maybe you're smiling at the image the way I'm smiling now. So I'm mentioning these as an observation, but it suggests to me that you have a certain amount of confidence. I'll use that word again in your writing. These are intentional moves on your part. Poets don't do anything without intention. Do you like to talk directly to the reader?
Yes, very much so.
Okay.
Very much so. A sense of conversation, and that's come from poetry that I admire a lot in part, and in part, it creates an energy and a flow, and helps me find the poem. So it's not just what I'm describing and what I'm talking about, but the tone, the tone really holds the poem together, and that conversational tone is one that I've found, I don't know if comfortable is the right word, but valuable.
It works. It works. Yeah. It feels like we're having a conversation with you. So you did it. You nailed it, I think, Brian. So I think another thing that holds poems together, at least suggests some sort of togetherness, is form, the way they look on a page, right? The way
yes.
the words are shaped. The millions of listeners that tune in all the time and hear me say this, but I react instantly to when I see a poem on the page, right? The way it's shaped. It might look structured, formal. There could be a lot of broken lines, maybe not even much punctuation at all. It immediately gives off a signal about what type of poem this is going to be. Whether the poet intends it, and he or she certainly must, because so when you do, when does form become obvious to you that a certain, you know, poem will take a certain shape, and why do you vary your shape, your forms? This is all free verse, but
yeah, it's all free verse, and there is a variety of shape on the page, and it again, it kind of comes out of a messing around, and I should back up a little bit, and I should say one of the forms that you'll find and that I've been gravitating toward more and more has sort of shorter and longer lines, and then it's got a fair amount of space in there, and it took me a long time to arrive at that. I felt there was a time when my poems were almost a little too tight, a little too compact, and it was the metaphor I think of is it's like the cellophane that goes across a microwave dinner. It's like it's stretched too tight, and I was looking for ways of like with a fork kind of poking mm-hmm. holes into it as a way of giving myself some breathing room in the poem. And it took me a long time to discover that for myself. So that's a little background. And then to kind of go back to your question, it evolves in parallel with the evolution of the poem as I'm writing it. So I really start with I'm going to shape the poem this way, or I'm going to shape the poem
okay.
that way. As I get a better sense of the tone of the poem, I get a sense of where I want to break the lines, and then that helps me give me an idea of okay, what kind of a container might this work better in?
Yeah, great. And it works the same way for a reader too, right? This idea of air, and I think that was really well described. Breathing, right? So I want to go back to where poems come from for you. Can you talk a little bit about that? Inspiration, if that is a meaningful word for you, or if this is just something which I would accept that you just need to do, or you're gonna, you know, lose your mind or something if you don't write things down. I get that too.
again the latter, or maybe it's somewhere in between. I do, you know, often I start with maybe experiences, but I find that the poem shifts on me, and often the maybe the experience that I start with isn't exactly what I end up with at the end. And sometimes even the experience takes kind of a secondary role, and I'm starting to discover, again, part of it is the way I'm expressing it. It's the expression that starts to kind of carry it, and what I thought the moment was about, it ends up not being about that. And again, and that sort of playing with words kind of starts to carry me somewhere else. So the poem ends up with a different focus than it's really, wow, I've got this flash of inspiration. I got to get this thing written down. It's more I'm getting got an idea for a moment, or I'm getting phrases on the page, and those lead to other phrases and other things, and they take me to something else. Because the first thing, honestly, that I started writing about was quite boring, and I'm quite bored with it. Or my wife, who reads all my poems, looks at a draft and she's quite bored with it, and then we got to find a way to move on from there, right?
That's not the word you want associated with your writing, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I got to ask you a question for myself. So the Dakota Jazz Club in downtown Minneapolis shows up in one of your poems. I love that place.
Yeah.
And I hope it survives COVID.
Yes.
So you reference a particular performer, unless this performer is a generic performer, but I gotta know who you're talking about.
Suzanne Vega. It was a wonderful concert.
Oh, right.
It was wonderful. Yeah.
Thank you. Now I'm happy. Now we're done. No, not. Minneapolis shows up in other places in here, and the Mississippi River does, and I found myself wanting to, you know, figure out where on the river you were writing about. Are these particular places, or are they just sort of?
Yeah. I live 6 blocks from the river. Yeah, nice. I live in South Minneapolis. Actually, I was just walking over there this afternoon. It was a bit chilly, a bit windy.
Yeah. But there almost every day myself. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah. Yeah, and it has a presence in my life, and I did want to have that work its way into my poetry as well.
This is off the tracks a little bit here, but did you go down underneath the Stone Arch Bridge when they lowered the water? Did you keep track of that happening?
Yes.
Was that amazing?
Yes.
Oh. Wow. All right. Well, that's apropos of nothing. Back to poetry. I have a lot of questions here. Poems and prose show up as epigraphs in your poems. So leads me to wonder, so who are your favorite writers? You can talk about why you chose some poems.
Yeah. So Christopher Gilbert is one who I've actually relatively recently discovered, but he's really at the top of my list. He came out with one book in his life. It was in the early 80s. But then he wrote a bunch of other stuff, and Grey Wolf came out with a collection of all of that a few years ago. It's called Turning Into Dwelling. Turning Into Dwelling. And everyone who's listening to this right now should get that book. I came across it in one of my favorite bookstores. It was just there, and it's mind blowing poetry. So
awesome! Thank you.
The epigram, they're there for a reason, but I wanted to get him in.
Nice.
Regardless.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, good. And so he's clearly an influence.
Yeah.
We're running down. I think you saw our good friend Liz there in the studio hold up some fingers, letting us know we're getting close.
Yeah.
So before I ask any other questions, let's get to what you're working on next, or where we can find some of your work beyond this book, which everyone should buy. You have a website, you keep poems on your website?
I have a website. It's briansatram.com. It's all one word, Brian satram.com.
What's your next project?
I'm working on another book. Actually, I'm well into another book. Not much of it has been published out there yet, but I'm hoping to get it out there in the world and then get that on my website.
Do you plan, are you one of these poets who likes to get most of the poems out there in some way, shape, or form before they're collected in a book?
I really do. And it's something I didn't, in the early days of my writing, I wasn't doing very much. And of late, I've really been working on getting my work out there in the world more. So this, you know, this book is a wonderful first step in that direction.
It's a wonderful first step. Yeah, I hope you get much more. Let's not pay attention to what Liz is going to tell us, but let's sneak one more poem in. What do you think?
Okay.
You got one?
I was going to read the title poem.
Okay.
Starting again.
Perfect.
The moon grows fuller from right to left, and it's spreading darkness too. Later in the month, from right to left, things I'm discovering. The sun came up this morning in the glass of downtown, and for a moment, I thought of all of us as windows of flame before the sky dulled again. You're quieter, having a harder time just being, though there's nothing out of the ordinary to point to, maybe because, and I'm not helping much. A transplant from LA, enamored of the Midwest. You always find ways to celebrate the seasons, picking up a red leaf from the sidewalk, placing it as a centerpiece on the dining room table. I give you a kiss on the mouth as a way of avoiding answering your question. You asked what I was doing when I got out of bed last night to jot down a note in pencil. I was starting again, seeing what I can piece together by naming one thing I know, so later I can add to it another.
That was great. Thank you, Brian. That's Brian Satram reading from Starting Again, his collection of poems. What a treat to meet you.
It's wonderful to be on the show. I just want to call out, too, that Subtext Book and Majors and Quinn actually have this in their stores that are actually open. You can actually walk in and browse. So they're wonderful stores otherwise too, but I just thought I'd mention that. So
thank you for doing that. I should have asked you, Subtext and Majors and Quinn, you can get Brian Satram's book, Starting Again there. And you listeners can listen to this and many other shows on our podcast. Get it, your podcast going, people. That's it, Liz. Can I turn this back to you now? And thank you, Brian.
Thanks so much, Dave.
All right. Bye-bye.